Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to episode number 15 of the Create More podcast with me, Ben Stewart. On this fortnight's podcast, we have Sam Barkley. Now, Sam is, he works for our graphics team at Make, and more importantly, he has set up two very successful Kickstarter campaigns. The reason I was really interested in this is I love Kickstarter. If you listen to Series 1, you would have heard the Thames Bath Kickstarter campaign, which I absolutely loved. And I think the idea of Kickstarter I find very inspirational. And as part of the whole, I did a presentation at Make's offices about the podcast. And what it made me realize was the very reason for it existing was to create more, as cheesy as that sounds. And to me, Kickstarter is the perfect way to do that. Sam's done 2 Kickstarter campaigns, which we talk about in depth in this podcast. So the 2 Kickstarter campaigns he's done are both based around the same book or similar versions of the book. One, so it's called I Wonder What It's Like to Be Dyslexic, and it's gorgeous book. I mean, it's all about the graphics involved and the idea of what it's like to read if you suffer from dyslexia. And it's been really, really well received. It's been in the Huffington Post. It's been on all sorts of kind of cool websites. And it, as I said, it is gorgeous. And the website reading.com, reeding.com is where you can find out more about the book. Sam works, Sam by day, some sort of superhero. Sam by day works at Make. He works for our graphics department, who are amazing. So I'm going to give him a little shout out. That's Tom, Xander, Emily, and Sarah. And they, as another little shout out, they've just finished our number 12 annual, which is brilliant. So go on the Make website and look into that, because they just keep upping their game every year. So they probably got to start now to beat the one this year for number 13. So I think what I'm going to do is this week or this fortnight, I've got Sam on and we'll be talking all about how to do a Kickstarter campaign, you know, why Kickstarter's awesome. Like, obviously Sam suffers from dyslexia. So like why he got into kind of typography and what universities went to and things. It's really, really good fun. And we do just go off on a few tangents. I won't lie to you, it's quite a long podcast. It's amusing, it's entertaining, but if you're expecting a very short, concise podcast about Kickstarters, probably just go on the internet and type it on Google. This is not the place we're going to find a very short, short, punchy, well-edited topic. That's Sam. And then next fortnight, I'm going to sit down with a guy called Peter, and he's done another Kickstarter campaign, which has also been very successful. And he's designed a folding bike, the world's lightest folding bike, no less. And what's been amazing is I've kind of seen him do it, you know, right from the beginning to where he is now, and it's brilliant. So the thing I love about the idea of Create More is, as I said, create more. But this idea to me is the idea that Kickstarter, so anyone can really do any idea, you've got to sell it on Kickstarter. So I think if you're looking for inspiration to do stuff, this is totally a great podcast to do that, because it just kind of shows you that you know, just put mind to it and you can come up with stuff. And Sam's really got quite a lot of money, you know, not personal wealth and fortune, but you know, as we discussed in the podcast, the idea of money is a trust and investment on the part of the public to is a kind of, you know, as a great way to do a book. So it's a really, really cool podcast. I really hope you enjoy it, and I'll talk more about the Kickstarter special on the other end. So I really hope you enjoy it. Enjoy. Bye bye. All right, so...
I need my coat.
Hang on, let me grab the book. So, like... I'm just going to go in with an introduction. I'm just going to say we're started now. How do you feel that for pressure?
All right.
Yeah, good, yep. Good. So I'm here with Sam Barkley, who... I'm going to let you describe your book. Because I do an intro, so I'll have already explained... I'll explain from the top what this is to really lull people in and get them like involved.
Get away from not doing an intro.
Yeah, yeah. So you can do my intro for me. I might just start the podcast with no intro and just going straight.
So
into
you just want to know the subject of the book to start with.
Well,
and then we'll go into it.
Yeah, basically. Why don't you? Yeah. So this is all. And this isn't just about your book, but this is like a great thing about your book. I want to talk about Kickstarter as well in general. Okay. But the first part of this is going to be about the book.
Okay.
So what is it?
It's obviously, it's called I Wonder What It's Like to Be Dyslexic, but for people that can't see it. And it gives people an experience of what it feels like to struggle with reading, not just dyslexia, but struggle with reading, so learning languages or whatever. But it's purely typographic. So it uses typographic experiments to show what it's like to struggle with reading.
Yeah, because, I mean, you only gave this to me today, but I had a good look through it at lunch. You'll be glad. I did my research. And I had no idea what to expect because when you said, when you pitched it to me, it's like it's a, I want to say topographical, but that's not the right word.
Typographic.
Typographic, yeah, there you go. Yeah. I was like, okay. I'll look through it. But what was really interesting is you lay it out in such a way that I suddenly understood why typefaces are done in the way you are. Because you obviously work in our graphics department, right? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
As well as doing this fantastic book. But I've never, this is, because I've never really looked into it. Like, I guess, why would I in my normal day-to-day find out about typography? That's the word.
Yeah.
I'm looking for typography.
Sorry, yeah, typography, yeah.
And this isn't your first book, is it?
That's the second kind of revision of that book. So this book is more content in it than the first one. So you having that one in your hand is basically the first one plus a bit.
Okay, this is the one I get to keep for free for doing the podcast. No, I have to pay for it. So hang on. So let's rewind a bit then. So the first book you did is kind of the same, but this is a lot more in depth. Or did you revise all the graphics? Or
when I did the first one, it was about two years ago now. So this one is everything I've learned from design because when I created the first one, it was at uni. So everything I've learned since then has gone into that. And also other bits, just looking through it and, you know, reading the first one.
So I'm gonna pretend that we don't talk every day at work and you haven't explained quite a few bits, because the problem we have to people who don't listen is we're two people. I can't walk past you without ended up chatting relentlessly about so many random things, and then we both go, oh, I do have work to do. I'm gonna
that's what I feel like as well. Just I should leave.
Yeah, let's do a podcast, otherwise we won't do any work. So the reason I got you on the podcast was, one, I'm holding your book just up like a shield, but one, I'm fascinated by Kickstarter. So this is the second podcast that I've did one last year about an architectural project done with Kickstarter, which is the Thames Lido, which is brilliant.
Yep, amazing.
And and then
really, really cool.
Yeah, and then what's great about Make is that you, and especially doing this podcast to Make, is I end up having conversation with people, and then I had a conversation with you, and you're like, oh, by the by, I did a Kickstarter. And I was like, I had no idea you had. And then you're like, oh yeah, raised how much money for your first Kickstarter?
55,000.
55,000. No,
well, I don't like the. I don't. I find.
Come on, it's a little bit cool.
Yeah. No. Yes, you're right. But I really struggle with. I'm very modest, I guess.
You weren't lying on a bed of money, basically.
No, I don't. Yeah. I send you a photo of the kind of throne in the back of the van of all the books that we made.
Oh, yeah, there's a picture in the back of this,
yeah,
one, isn't
it? Yeah. That was quite funny. But I find it very awkward to talk about it in terms of the success, as much as, you know, it is a great thing, and the money side of it is kind of, that's the one side of talking, getting into the Kickstarter side of it, is that it's very, very open to how much money you have made. So people know, people, whoever you are, whatever, if they find out you've done a Kickstarter, they can find out instantly how much you've made. And suddenly think, oh Christ, £55,000! Like, what have you spent? You must have had a massive party. Yeah. Like, well, no, like not all of that money goes straight into, like, well, actually, a small amount of that money goes to my pocket because you've got to fulfil the product that you're making. So that it's kind of, I guess, to skip a few jumps of talking about Kickstarter. It's a very odd feeling when that money comes into your account because one, it's like, oh my God, I've never seen that figure in my bank account before ever in my life. But at the same time, you suddenly think there's all that hard work from the Kickstarter campaign that we'll talk about, I guess, in a bit. But then it's the hard work then begins for much, much longer. And but it's exciting. It's an incredible, but
So once the, you know, the champagne and the booze and the parties ended, you're like, oh damn, I've got a lot more to do now. Well, I do think that, I mean, I'm totally winding up about the money because I find that fascinating about Kickstarter that it is a large chunk of money, but actually every pound of that's pressure on you to achieve exactly what you set out to do. And I think, I mean, we'll jump around wildly around the subject of Kickstarter because that seems to
well,
be...
Well, the other, just before you go, I don't know where you're going, but...
Neither do
the
I.
The other side of it is that what I found that is enormous amount of pressure is that with Kickstarter, and I'm not, I don't mean this in a bad sense that for Kickstarter, but there is, you don't sign a contract to fulfill that orders. So, you know, you as a person I could have just buggered off to Barbados and spent, you know, a good amount of time there and not fulfilled the orders. But there is that sense of pressure that you have signed a contract with yourself, with those people publicly to fulfill those orders. And if you don't, then you've got a lot of explaining to do. And it's kind of like, and even if you didn't fulfill those orders and those money's come back, you've got to have a good reason to not fill those orders. Because the first book, I think it was something like 1,300 and something people. I mean, the grand scheme of things of population, that's not that much. But me personally, if there was 1,300 people sat in front of me, it'd be well intimidated. So it's kind of, and it is kind of that. The only barrier is the internet.
But weren't you just fresh out of uni and you just, this is like the, so most people would get a job or, you know, start low down and then work their way up. but you decided to just, well, this is why I think it's fascinating because anyone getting that amount of money and that amount of orders is a big thing. But you having... Kickstarter kind of, I guess, in my head must lull you into thinking, yeah, I can do this. Oh, crap, I've got to produce 1,300 books now. That's
Well, the first book I printed, well, the first few, but obviously prototypes at uni, because the book started at uni, I'll explain that story as well. But the first book I printed was on an A3 printer at home in my bedroom, just printing out sheets, reloading it back in to print the other side. And then you all of a sudden go... You're printing on a massive a litho printer that's, you know, as long as the studio is wide, and it's a big learning curve straight out of uni, because you've never, obviously uni, you don't, depending on, you know, various unis at wherever uni you're at or how much money you potentially have at uni, but you never print on a printer that size,
no,
or deal with the different processes or the different kind of techniques that you have to think about to use to finish a book.
Well, I think as well that I had this conversation, the very first podcast I did was with Assemble Studios. They're like a fantastic architecture practice, but the way they started,
what did you?
They did cinema in the petrol station. They kind of, out of uni. Yeah, but yeah, I always said to her that seems like the perfect stepping stone after university is to do a live project. That teaches you way more than you'll ever learn by being in a big office. Yeah. And I think from what you're just saying as well, that what an amazing way to not just learn about topography, but also how the publishing industry works.
The whole process,
everything.
So well, if you went into a job, you wouldn't learn that kind of process. You go straight to intern, then junior, but you probably wouldn't. I guess it depends on what studio you're working on, what projects you work on, but to actually go on press that early on. I don't know if it is quite rare, because I guess, you know, you're a learning curve, but to have your own project and and to fulfill it all the way through is very rare, as you know, basically straight out of uni.
I think it's amazing, because Well, okay, let's go back to, see, you started a Kickstarter campaign, but you know, when you put something on Facebook or something, you get a few likes, you're like, that's cool, I've got a few more friends, all right, yeah. Cool. But it must be so exciting putting something on Kickstarter and watching you know, the money go up. This isn't just like a like, you know, just like a, I just click like. This is like actual people's money, which is a whole separate thing. I mean,
That's,
you're getting money out of people's pockets. So you had to, do videos and set up a website? And...
Well, yeah, that was, so I guess, I don't know if it helps to explain.
Yeah.
Like, I won't explain how the book came about first. We'll do this bit first. After, you know, deciding to go on Kickstarter, luckily had a lot of help from my brother, but that at first I didn't realize how much hard work it was. And there was, you know, you have to come up with the story and you know, the whole worded story of
Kickstarter is like a
of why this book exists, why people want it, why people need it, who it's for, and you know, the various different avenues of who it can be for and why. And just kind of deciphering that is enough for its own. Even just working, you know, shooting the book itself, not shooting it literally, photo.
Yeah.
And sorting all that. And yeah, and then the video, and then organizing press and stuff, contacts.
So you became your own little company, basically.
I mean, like the thing that baffles me is when I was listening to your other podcast of the Thames Baths. That's on a whole nother scale to me, but I guess, you know, there's other people involved as well. But yeah, some of them you look and you think, I don't understand how you can organise all that. That's a lot.
You say that, but I mean, doing a model and renders and 3D stuff is having looked through this book and seen how much complication and, you know, how much information there is in there. I would imagine that it's very similar levels. It's just different scales, right?
Yeah, but I suppose it's just when you don't understand something, it seems like a bigger task than anything.
Did you at any point think, I don't know if I can do this? Or were you, because was the book kind of done before you even started the Kickstarter? Or was the Kickstarter was just a way to publish the book? Or did okay, fine.
So enough. The book was designed at uni. We talked about this, but yeah. So the book came about from a brief at university. It was a competition brief, and I think it's six briefs every year.
Which university is this?
Portsmouth.
Good
old. And actually, going back to the Facebook thing of the whole likes thing, that one big time when I was actually, it made me realise how brilliant Portsmouth is, because obviously it is an island, but that's kind of irrelevant, but what made me realise the good sense of community there is, and all, like, you know, the friends and stuff that I have there, is I never had that many amount of likes as soon as Kickstarter launched. It was just ridiculous, and I never even expected it. Awesome. It just kept shooting up, and people are sharing this, like putting it. It's like, whoa, it's only me. What are you doing this for? It's me. But it's mad. But
I think people want to support you, but putting yourself out there. I think people you don't realize that you get scared, and then you put it out there, and people like really supportive. You're like, oh, I don't know why I thought people wouldn't be supportive.
Yeah, I guess.
But you were explaining how the Brave Book started and at Portsmouth University as a competition. Yeah.
So there's a society called International Society of Typographic Design.
Say that again. International Society
of Typographic Design. ISTD. very good organization, though, because they, or society, because they create awareness for students, or help students understand the macro, micro, very finer details and the beauty of typography and why it's so important, and helping students to learn the finer details of it, because it's a huge subject, and when you think about it in terms of, you know, it's part of, it's going off a little bit, but language and how long we've taken to develop this this tool of type and typography from just making marks on a wall, it's pretty amazing. When if you'd see, if you get it came to this earth first, like for the first time ever and you saw this O curved in such a way, you think, what the heck? Oh, what is all of this? And all these different like symbols. It looks mad. If you look at it like, well, that on the cover.
Yeah.
When you start to take away that you don't recognize it as a letter, it looks absolutely crazy. And when you, like, if you try and look at an A and not look at it as an A, it looks mental.
Yeah.
But and
I like the front cover. I should describe the front cover is, it says...
Well, you take some photos.
Oh, yeah, I'll take some photos. I'll put that on the front cover of the podcast. There you go. But I like the fact it's like half letters, isn't it? But yeah. your mind can still decipher what it says, even though, as you just said, what a random... Yeah. Looking at it, you're like, what
well, that's a typeface done by a guy called Philip Baines, who actually worked. I think he. I can't remember what uni he worked at. No, I've forgotten.
So you're doing the competition?
Yeah, sorry, I'm ISTD, and they give a few briefs out to different universities, and well, any university can take part in the kind of competition, but it's graded. It's not like there's a winner, first, second, third. So it's graded, and the briefs are quite a challenge because they're very open ended. And I ended up choosing a brief called Book Still, and you had to explain the idea of a book. You had to use the book as a tool to kind of explain it a little bit and how we see it and the form of the book, whether it's printed or digital. I think I'm explaining that right. And I kind of liked you had to explore the form of the book. That's a better way of explaining it. And I decided to look at how we read with typography, because obviously it's in conjunction, but it's two kind of different things, because how we read and how we see type, they're almost two different directions of fields of things, but we understand them so close together, but actually they're quite two separate fields.
Because in the book, the thing I liked is it's the first time I've really thought about the spacing.
Yeah.
Of because I use InDesign all the time, and I know what I like the look of.
Yeah.
And I think that looks good. I don't know if I think it looks good, or I know that that's what things I like. I'm repeating, but I don't know why the spacings or the gaps, and the gaps between the letters make a huge difference. Everything being caps lock make a huge difference. It's a really interesting kind of way to, you like, it is draining to read a paragraph of caps lock text.
Massively so, yeah.
It wasn't until I looked through a book and it's like, yeah, fair enough. And then when the letters are incredibly closely spaced together.
I mean, that's an exaggeration as well, but it kind of showed like you wouldn't believe how many things based on dyslexia that I've seen that the typography isn't considered. When the dyslexic person, that's the very thing that they struggle with. So surely if the type is set wrong, there's another barrier there that it isn't like a paragraph set justified. There's no, you know,
So that's when the paragraph looks square, isn't it? Every space between the word fills the width of whatever box you're putting.
Yeah. Just the amount of stuff done like that based around dyslexia or on the subject of dyslexia kills me. Like,
do you read that and go, oh, the irony?
I don't even read it.
Just get angry.
No. even if I need to put it aside. No, I don't do that.
So then, because I know where the story goes, and I like the ending, which is you go back to the competition. So you submitted, was it a version of this book? The first one.
Yeah. So that. See, then after countless bits of development and God knows what, and wrestling with, because at the time I explained to you this before, but at the time everyone at uni was kind of redesigning a book that they already knew or loved, and expressing that in a way through typography. And I kind of didn't really want to take a book that already existed. I almost sort of mould my own way into a book, which is kind of daunting as well, because you have to produce certain content and there's a word count. I think you have to have something like 3,000 words in the book. So to produce that, as well as being dyslexic, as well as having a dissertation as well, it's just like, what am I doing? So then at the same time, I was jumping between the idea to redesign the book, The Prestige, from the film, the same book film, which is a very, very good book.
Oh, I haven't read the book. I was about to say the film, but I've not read
the book. And the book. If you haven't read the book, you should read the book. It's really, really, really good. Because then it's one time when the book you know, you have a film and the book, and the film ruins the book, and all that. They don't, because it's two different stories. It's almost that Christopher Nolan has taken a part of the book and expressed it in a different sort of way, but the same sort of story. That's, I can't explain it until you've read it. You will, and everyone listening to this podcast will have to read it. But it's
have to read it. It's an order. Yeah. You've heard it here. Go on. Off you go. Go on.
So yeah, and then I was struggling, I was battling with the how you read with typography idea. Like, I couldn't find a path for it to fit and it to all work. So I was kind of taking the what I could see was the easier option of redesigning the Prestige. And it wasn't until me and a friend of mine, who will hopefully listen to this at some point when I tell him, that me and him went to the pub one night, because I was stressing out about it, and sat down and just had a couple of beers and a pizza, and I took time away from work, which I kind of find it, you know, sometimes you get buried in work at uni and you think it's all about work, but actually it is quite important to take them breaks just to do, well, I guess life in general, isn't it, with work. But yeah, then he kind of said to me that I was actually being ridiculous in leaving that idea just because it's a headache. Was, you know, it's kind of stupid to neglect it and leave it just because it's got hard. It doesn't mean that it's not working.
Yeah.
So then went home for a week. I was Thursday, you know, but we had to submit on the Tuesday to uni for the lecturers decide whether we'd submit to the competition. So it's like a midway point. So I just realised I'm going to stop doing that because that's probably booming through the mic as well. I went home on the Thursday and didn't come back until the Tuesday, like 7 in the morning till 3 in the morning, working my socks off just to make one prototype of this book.
Yeah.
So I knew I've kind of suddenly found the path of it fitting in with dyslexia as well, with typography and how we read.
There is nothing more satisfying than finding that eureka moment.
You're my God.
I've got it. Yeah. I've got it.
Get up on top of it. Yes. Can I
ask, with your tutors, when you showed the book, were they like, when they, because I would imagine that some of the tutors weren't dyslexic, were they looking at it and going, you're making words up here, aren't you? And you're like, yeah, no, that I'm dyslexic and that's how I read it. And they're like, yeah, but is it? And you're like, is your decision right? Or were there other dyslexic people you showed it to? And they're like, does this make sense to you? Or?
Well, that was the eureka moment, because I found a tool that's like a phonetic tool, but it's a simplified phonetics, so it's not got all the like the glyphs and stuff in it. It's more simplified.
And
True spell.
That was it. That's what I was looking for. Yeah.
So, and it is actually an American phonetic. It's done in the American accent. So the spellings, if you read it true to how the letters are, you would almost, and you read it out loud, it would potentially give you an American twang. Which is quite funny, because if you read it out loud, as in you, but
what I like is that you were in the book, you explain exactly what we're talking about here, and you were explaining like when you're reading True Sense, that's more what it's like for someone with dyslexia reading normal text. I was forcing myself to read every word slowly, and like I was like mouthing the words, going, "What does? Oh, that's what that means." Okay, what
but that's
that?
Exactly. Yeah. But in you know, when text isn't edited in that way, that's what it's kind of like for someone with dyslexia. But at the same time, I'd like to point out that I don't claim in any way, shape or form that this book is exactly what it's like to have dyslexia, because it's impossible. Because everyone is completely different. Every person with dyslexia has different variables or different things. So it's kind of impossible to explain what someone has, what it's like to have dyslexia. So, it's just an interpretation of maybe a vast or a small or whatever amount of dyslexic people of what it's like, or even also people that do struggle with reading. So people coming from a different country, learning English for the first time. And that eureka moment as well, going back to the uni, was when I found True Spell. And I suddenly thought that actually some of these words are exactly how I spelt them when I was in like junior school. And it kind of suddenly twigged, and that like, and then that's when the whole dyslexia thing really crept its way in. And the hard work began as well, actually.
And it's, I've never been happy since.
No, I've got to thank the lecturers at Portsmouth Uni, especially a guy that's left now, but Alex Tibbis. He was a tremendous help with the book, actually.
I don't know how to tread around what is saying things about dyslexia, but did
go for it
with graphics and stuff. Did you find that it was easier to present stuff than write stuff? So your way to express stuff and explain stuff was through, like, I don't want to say colors and shapes, but if like presenting
the visuals,
stuff, the visuals, yeah, because yeah, this book is gorgeous to look at, but like. Were you good at the graphics before this book?
Good at the graphics.
Good at the graphics. I couldn't generalise that in a word. So, you know what I mean? When you started uni, did you find that it was easy to do graphics? I shouldn't say graphics, you know what I mean?
Actually, looking back at some of my work, when I went into the degree, I was terrible. I actually did not have a clue, because graphic design is such an odd... It's a mishmash of so many different subjects that is not really its own subject, because there's science, philosophy, psychology, maths, art, obviously, and so many more others that are probably obvious that I'm kind of forgetting of. Language as well, like English and, you know, the kind of thing. And then it's quite a tool to understand, if you know it. There's a lot to it, and then and at the start of uni, I would admit, going back looking at some of my work, it's like, gee, what are you doing? you can say that for, I think a lot of people may say that when they started uni, if they didn't really have an interest in it, well, not like knew that was their career path, then it does take some time to actually understand it.
So you did the book.
I should tell what's funny. Before I started university, I was a plumber for 6 years, and I also when I decided that plumbing wasn't for me, I actually wanted to study architecture, which is kind of funny. Working in an architecture practice now as a graphic designer.
Well, that's interesting, because when I started architecture, I wanted to be a graphics designer.
No, you didn't.
Yeah. No, I love presenting stuff.
Oh, okay.
Everyone always winds me up that, like, there's very little content, but it's well presented, but there's not. I spent more time presenting it than I ever did. Yeah. So any of my friends listening to will be giggling, because they called it putting jam on it. They were like, we'd work together, we'd do the same document, but I would spend ages presenting it. And I would get a better mark than them, and it would drive them mad. But I find graphics amazing, but I genuinely don't know why I like the things. And it was nice reading your book, like going through it. And I'd never really thought about it. If you think of how many different typefaces you see on any given day, on any given website, you know, like, I read Wired all the time, and I was going to ask you, because we've got a bit of time, I like to meander through these podcasts, but do you not think this is a great time to be a graphic designer? There seems to be an explosion of apps on phones, which people, especially kind of, I think Apple apps seem to just be gorgeous to look at, and websites now are gorgeous to look at, and I don't know, like, people's tolerance for, like, what is a good website now is so high.
There does seem to be more awareness, but they, you know, I didn't live in a time when, well, you know, we only live in this time now, don't we? So I don't know if it was any, you know, I don't know if it was any different. And I could say yes, but I don't know.
For example,
it is more like you're right. I know what you're saying. It's it is more. It is becoming more and more predominant because of, phones and screens and stuff. And obviously, you know, one of the whole big reasons that Steve Jobs put into computers was typography and type. And that's, you know, it was one of his paths to get to where he was, that studying typography and stuff.
Because also with, like, 4K displays and phones and computer screens and stuff, like, the quality that you can see stuff in is just, it's like, it's better than print now, isn't it? But,
it's absolutely better than print, yeah. And that's absolutely insane how a screen the type is clearer than you'll ever be able to physically print something.
Yeah.
But then it's almost quite nice because it's, oh, here we go. It's
go
kinda,
on, I know you want to say.
It kind of like, it almost softens the edges a little bit to, and it sits, sometimes sits a little bit better in the space it's in rather than having, I don't know whether this is getting like a personal opinion or not. I don't, I haven't really properly looked into it. But for me, when you print something, it kind of, the ink bleeds into the page and you get that a little bit of fuzz, not that you'll notice it, but it sits into the page a little bit more. So when you're reading, it's a little, it's kind of softer. But with this screen, it's so crisp that you almost have to get the contrast between the background and the type for it to kind of balance right for you to be able to read it clearly. But I totally agree.
I think as well that
it'd be an interesting study. Yeah?
I mean, the thing that
maybe
I like,
not for some,
interesting for who? Because no, we just, well, I say we, you guys have just issued our make annual, which is brilliant. And what I love about it, and I always am surprised, is the difference.
Those two are amazing as well, by the way, really, really. And they'll be listening to this.
Go on, you name drop. Go on, you can name drop.
Well, Kirsty and Tom, yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, it's great to work with them too.
And then it's the quality of paper and the print. I'm always blown away by, like, because in the annual, different pages have different, like, paper feel, and it does...
Yeah, the dividers and the cover and the main bulk of it.
Because it genuinely makes a difference, but it's not something, you know, you just print stuff out, right?
Yeah, here we go.
But, I mean, yeah, I just... Because I obviously go to your desk quite a lot, and it's the kind of all those paper samples you have. You know that amazing booklet that I always want to steal off your desk?
Geo Smith,
Yeah. And it always has, like...
chunky thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's wicked. Just from, like, a paper feel, which is something you kind of lose when you don't print something, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, well, it can become... It's one of those things that can become a bit of a gimmick. But if you use it in the right way, then it never is. I mean, sometimes gimmicky things are quite nice, and paper is sometimes the thing you can be quite gimmicky with a little bit and almost get away with it. But at the same time, it has a purpose, because you have to not only think about the thing you're designing, but how is this going to look on a piece of paper? I mean, some things might not look quite right on a bright white piece of paper because... this, that, and the other, but some things might not look good on a book white, which is like an off-white.
Yeah. I was going to say, because I noticed, because you guys, because we're in a new office, I should say, Makes Office, relatively new, it's like a year old probably now, but I noticed Tom and the team are kind of, they're always printing stuff at the right size, you know, to get a feel of what it would look like. So the whole office every now and again is just covered in these random different text fonts and sizes of stuff. You know, what does it look like from the back of the office? Wasn't it like...
Did you ever see when we were trying to decide the type size?
Yep.
That was a day. A day. Between, and the funny thing was, I don't know if you ever, so it was between... 7 and 9, I think it was, but we got it down to between 0.2 of a type size, because what the two different typefaces that were 0.2 of a typeface.
Yeah.
I mean, when you say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous, but it mattered to us, and it should do to everyone, and it does to a lot of one.
Yeah, 100%. But that's the thing, because
it makes a difference.
It does make a huge difference, and it's that level of attention that I think elevates it above. And
but this is a type of... I mean, you know, we're having a like this pub like chat, but I know who to talk about it when I'm actually in a pub. If I talk to this about certain mates, literally, like, I'm kicked out the door. You just like... Oh yeah, the bottom bit of the A. It's like, oh god.
It's like when I'm with my friend Tom and I'm with my wife Beck, and we start talking about architecture. She's like, oh, bored. Jesus Christ. But also, what's...
you can't help it.
Yeah, you know what you're saying, getting down to like 0.2 of a type font or whatever, and like no type one but font, you, your size. Don't judge me with my bad lingo. And you know, no one can notice. It's like, you know, when we were choosing the color of grey for like the plant on Broadgate, and I had two samples. And like Bex, my wife, saw me and she was like, they're exactly the same. I was like, they're not. They're totally different. She was like, Ben, they're exactly the same. It's like no one cares, Ben. Just use the color.
Bigger scale, you might notice the difference. And if you chose the wrong one, then...
But we've digressed again. So I'll bring it back. So you've just finished your book.
Couldn't even remember where we were.
Yeah. You finished your book.
Yeah.
And you were just about to tell me how well it was received.
Oh, yeah. So
there we go.
So you finished the book, and then ISTD had it away for marking for what seemed like forever. I think it was about a month. Something like that. Anyway, I got the results back through email and I was reading through all the results. It's kind of funny I haven't told you this, but reading through all the because they give you feedback on the book and it's like first comment like good, second comment good. So it's like, this is all right, this is cool, but where's the, how am I going to improve from what, how do I make this better? This is annoying. It's all just good. I mean, I know that's good,
yeah.
But at the same time, I, you know, how do I improve? And got to the where it gives you this specific grade. Is a commendation, and I had no idea what a commendation was, and I was with the guy that, you know, helped me decide the path of where the book went, and he was like, it must be like a, you know, just a just an average pass, like something like that, like, surely. And then a friend of mine at uni, he was kind of celebrating on Facebook about the grade he got, the same one as me, and I was like, What is a commendation? What is a commendation? I don't know what's going on. Is it just a pass? Have I passed? It was good feedback. And he's like, Sam, it's the hardest, the highest grade you can get that is ridiculously rare to get. And the and what made it even more crazy is that the lecturer, Mike Harkins, who runs the project at uni, he used to teach, well, he used to... used to go through all the work,
review, critique,
used to review it and grade it and yeah. Stuff. And he said to get a commendation is like trying to find a speck of gold in a mountain of sand. So to hear that from
and you were like, so this is good or
oh, I still got to do more work. But yeah, I didn't even really, because we got the grades before we'd finished uni, I didn't really have the chance to celebrate and stuff. So that's kind of odd. So yeah, and then, yeah.
So you get a commendation and then, because I always think this at uni work, you spend
Pentagram to get the award as well. That was cool.
Boom.
Mm. you obviously heard of, you would have heard of Pentagram, wouldn't
nope.
you? It's an architect. They've got an architect side to it, I'm pretty sure.
I would say my knowledge of architecture probably isn't the most rounded.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
This is my attempt to learn more.
Yeah, well, it's a big they've got a big design practice, and one of their studios that's in London. They've got another one in New York, and somewhere else, I think maybe. But the one in London's in Notting Hill, and it's a really, really, really nice studio. It's a big, big practice, and they do some phenomenal work and stuff, and some really well-respected people there. So to go there as, you know, just graduated was pretty cool.
It must be awesome to get an award. You're like,
especially...
yep, this one's mine.
Well, and the letters after your name, M-I-S-T-D, though. But member of International Society of Typographic Design, not anything weird.
We'll just leave that there. Yeah. So... Because I was thinking, like, is it uni work as well? Once you've done it, you live it, you breathe it, and then that's it. This is done. You never see it again. You know, it's no one cares about it.
Breathe it again.
Yeah. But then did you go, okay, were you like, people need to see my book? Or were you just a bit like, did someone mention Kickstarter? Oh, that sounds cool. Or how did you get into Kickstarter?
Well, obviously, uni's done. I don't want to look at the work you've done again, and you just want to leave it, and that's it, and you move on. And that's it. I put a lot of pressure on myself to try and find a job. So it was all guns blazing. That's all I'm doing. I worked, solidly on my self-promotion stuff. Like I made a fold-out A3 CV, like portfolio thing. Worked damn hard on that, like business cards and branding for myself, and, you know, collating all the projects that I'd done to try and get a job somewhere, and put maybe a little bit too much pressure on trying to get into a really, really high-end studio and maybe not lowering my standards a little bit. But
you must finish uni. I've just got a commendation. I must be pretty, well, bloody good.
The modesty in myself still, you know, comes out a little bit, and, you know, just wanting to get a job but at the same time and earn money because I didn't really want to work in a pub anymore. But and then that wasn't really happening because it's such a competitive time as well, because obviously there's a lot of people looking for a design position, and then obviously you get that kind of, you get a weird shift of you get people fresh out of uni looking for, you get it in every industry, I suppose, where the people like junior designers see it as a good time to find a position because obviously their portfolio and their experience is better than people at uni. So it's also a good time for them to look for jobs and vice versa as you go up. And then after a while of not finding a job, my brother mentioned to me about Kickstarter. I didn't have a clue about Kickstarter. I didn't even know what it was until sort of reading into it. Didn't really understand it. I didn't really understand it until I was kind of in and on the... I guess I must have. I don't really remember. Know what I was doing, obviously. But he mentioned it to me. I had a look around and... looking at other projects, like researching, seeing how we could do it.
Can I ask, going on your Kickstarter thing today, having seen a few Kickstarters now...
Did you look at both of them, or just which one did you look
at? I
need it
to the one for this. This is the, okay. Because you've got a Kickstarter currently open right now, haven't you?
No,
this one's all done and dusted.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you smashed your pledge, didn't you?
Yeah.
I was wondering, do they give you a website builder? They're like, this is the Kickstarter template. This is what each bit should go in.
Well, it's different now to when it's finished and when it's live. So when it's live, your campaign will come up immediately. But when it's done, the updates come up immediately. Yeah. So it's the big picture and you can add buttons now, which is really good. Because before... when the first one ended, me and my brother watching it ending, we're like, oh yeah, when it's ended, to the story bit of explaining the project. When it's done, we'll add in a little bit for a button so then people can click to go straight to the website.
Yeah.
The project finishes and you can no longer edit anything. And we were like, no, we can't add anything to explain the way you can now get this book. So, but obviously... yeah, Google's a good thing, so that helped. But now it's obviously the campaign side is secondary when it's finished. So what you see is the updates, kind of timeline of how the project went, and you see all the updates coming through.
So for people who've never done a Kickstarter, then do you literally just go right down?
Are we just assuming that everyone knows what Kickstarter is? We haven't really explained that.
No, why don't you explain what Kickstarter is?
Well, I suppose they've seen they would have listened to the other.
I think you should explain.
It's crowdfunding. I think it's the easiest way to explain it, isn't it?
One of the Alistair Parvin, the WikiHouse one, was great because he was saying,
about six times, maybe more actually,
because he wants. I love the idea when he says, instead of one person with £1 million, a million people with £1.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of that. And I'm still trying to get my head around because I think there's a very subtle shift in how
you have
projects...
avoid having to go to the bank, don't you? Like the probably one thing that controls the way anyone thinks about starting a project is going to the bank.
Yeah.
And it's probably an incredibly daunting thing trying to start a project, going to the bank and then being like, I don't really get it. And it's like some uncreative guy you're trying to explain it to and they're just like, what? And then you're disheartened that project never exists. But yet, with Kickstarter, it's like anything is possible.
I'd never even thought of that.
You don't have to go and see the big band, do you?
I was listening to Scroobius Pip one, and he was saying, I can't remember the name of the band, but as a joke, they did they put a Kickstarter for like £100,000 to remix their album just using cat noises.
Did they do it?
Yeah, and it smashed the amount of money they had to make, and then they had to do it, but they gave all the money to charity.
Imagine going to the bank with that. Oh, I just want to remix my album with cat noises.
No, go with me on this.
Yeah. Or on Dragon's Den. Can you imagine that? Peter and like, God, they'd have a fit.
Let me play the CD. This is track 17.
Yeah. It's the pitch. I want £100,000 with a 2% share. And that's the other great thing is that you don't give any shares away of your company. It's just you're basically putting in, you're asking for people to pre-order your product. I don't really know how it potentially works with things like the Thames Bath, but...
The bath.
Yeah.
What happens if, when they get oversubscribed? Say yours is on national news or worldwide news for some reason, and suddenly a million people said, I'll get one of your books. You'd be like...
I've got to prevent it.
You'd be like, oh, what, how do you do that? Like, what, are you like, oh, I can't do a million. Can you? You can't cap it, can you? Can you cap it? You know, only 1,000 books available, or is
I
there just
you can't? Well, I don't know. I've never really thought of the idea of capping it, but I guess when you get to a certain level of money, then you can start to. I mean, if you know. It's hypothetical, but if the book did get to not £1 million, but 1 million people buying it, that's obviously, you know, that's probably like 20 million, maybe something like that. So then you start to think way, way bigger picture stuff when it's finished. So it would probably best to go to a publisher. Look, I've got this chunk of money and you can probably pay them a little bit to fulfill the audit, and then you give them the content and they just feed it all and sit back with a couple of million, go on a buy.
Yeah, woohoo!
But then, you know, there is other ways that you could control it yourself. So there are companies where you could go to them, go to certain printing companies where they have fulfillment services in-house. So, I mean, Christ, I don't know how long it would take to print a million books and fulfill that. Surely it would take a couple of months to do that.
I mean, we don't need to go into the logistics of it, but I imagine it'd be quite complicated.
Yeah.
But I I've heard, you know, the Kickstarter campaigns that you hear about predominantly are the ones that either smash their target like ridiculously. So you only ever really read about the 0.5%.
And that's amazing as well, isn't it? What a thing, like, you know, in the news, you only ever hear about the bad things. But Kickstarter and all those kind of things, you only really ever hear about the successful things. Yeah. And what a great thing, like what a great almost like industry or platform when you own, like, I mean, all right, you know, heart goes out to the people that haven't and that have great projects. And I have heard of, you know, a couple of people that I've worked with have, their first one wasn't successful, but the second one was. But at the same time, like you say, and most people, it's a broad thing. You only really hear about the successful things.
You've not really made me think about the idea of going to a bank manager and them just saying no. Do you know what I think is quite nice? Disheartening if you don't win your Kickstarter, you know, you don't get your minimum amount.
Well, that's the bank manager bit, isn't it?
Yeah, but I like the idea that you got 90% of the way there. You know, like, as opposed to someone just going no and you have no idea if they thought it was kind of good. But at least you can be like, do you know what? I was pretty close, actually. When do you ever have any sort of creative feedback which is quantifiable? You were 60% of the way there. You're like,
you got the variables are different. So you bank manager, there's one, or all right, you can go to different banks, but let's just say one. There's one bank manager that you can ask to whether they give you the money. But like you say, one with a lot, and you know that it's a different variable. So you've got more chance of succeeding depending on how much you believe and love your project and know that it's viable in the real world. But also, you know, it's a good way to do a market research at uncostly value to yourself and not lose any money.
I was going to say, did you get much feedback on it? Were they like, be good if it was quarter of the length, a bit long, isn't it? did you get feedback like that?
It was on Reddit, and it was on the first page of Reddit for a little while. And I've printed out all the comments, and you go through them, and some of them are like, oh, it's just some guy with a trendy book, like, no, oh, whatever. And it's like, oh, you haven't even read it. It's not even, oh, missed the point. But then, you know, and I've had some gruesome emails of people that think that it's a company, but it's just little old me sat at the end reading this email that's ranting on about, you know, how I should be giving this out for free, and that I'm taking advantage of dyslexia in itself and God knows what else. But saying, like,
did you respond to anything?
No, obviously not. Like, I didn't want to, and B, if I did, it would get me in all sorts of trouble, wouldn't it? And then eventually start to think, well, I probably shouldn't have said that. But at the same time, the bad feedback is actually quite interesting. And when you read it in terms of, and you kind of read between the lines of what they're saying, it actually helps. And I did go through all of the whole feed of Reddit, which is quite, I think it was 25 pages long of all these different comments of people getting arsey. And it was funny going through it because I could tell who were friends sticking up for me as well, which was quite nice.
Your whole team of moderators.
Yeah, yeah.
He's actually all right.
Yeah. He's not an idiot. It's...
That must have been
the first time reading it.
A bit shaky for your ego. Oh, yeah, they love it. Oh, they hate it.
Yeah.
Oh.
But then, as a graphic designer, you know, as an architect, we've talked about this, but I do like the criticism. I do like the you know, if everyone liked it, how could I improve it?
Mm.
And I like to read between the lines of what people are saying, even if they are just saying, "Oh, it's just a trendy book." Do you know what I mean? Like, how can I show these people that it's not just like some trendy, cool book? There is a purpose to it. There is a reason why I've done it. There is thought behind every single step of the way, and that is something that, you know, started to think about with potentially maybe the second one or things that I do in the future with it. And it's you learn from those things, I think, more so than you do the good one, because.
Mm.
The good stuff just boosts your ego, don't you? And it's stuff that your family or your mates always say, that they will always say, because it's not easy for them to say, "Ooh, that's not very good, is it?
This is awkward, it's crap."
But people that don't know you, they've got no, do you know what I mean? And it's a great way to improve. And I think the less personal you take those things, the more you can take something from it, I think.
I find... I always think of like people at uni, because I know a lot of people at uni listen to this, and then going out into the real world where you have to make money for everything. It's to me, it's like it's the absolute best way.
My money compared to what I deal with compared to what you deal with is,
I don't go anywhere near the money I have to deal with, though. That's the thing. It's like, but I think it's the whole cycle of a process, I think, is amazing. That's why I think I'm so fascinated with Kickstarter, is that you had an idea for a book. Normally you'd have to pitch a load of random people, but you just went out on your own, did it exactly how you wanted it to. That's what I really like about Kickstarters. For all their, you know, idiosyncrasies, that's the character. I always think, you know, this is your book. It's not like
then you are fighting against your own mind, whether this is right or wrong, and when is it finished, and when is something ever finished that you do yourself? When is it finished?
That's why I refuse to edit these podcasts, because I know that I would never stop editing them. I'd be too like, this is like in real time, this is edited by us, by talking.
I'm already thinking about the third one.
I was about to ask you, so are you already, is this going to be a continuation of this, the theme, or are you
I know that one's done, the book's kind of done. I was thinking about how I could potentially what I would do differently if it was going to be published by a publisher. And I'm thinking about that at the minute.
That's interesting. Why would you do it differently if it was by a publisher? What, as in for more mass market appeal type thing?
More stripped back. So I guess I haven't explained this, but so there's the short story that runs throughout the book each time. And that short story, the language and the type and the typography and the layout and type. Type and typography being two separate things.
This is the repeated short story.
Story that goes throughout. I was thinking that book there could potentially be more of a hardback, like special edition book, and the softbound like book like that could be much smaller, and just the short story run throughout and much thinner, so it's more stripped back to its actual meaning and purpose.
Have you been approached by schools or anything to do it as like a genuinely like more like infographic educational thing? Because
I've been to one or two schools to give like to talk to the dyslexic children there, and given a few talks and stuff. One at the Oasis. I don't know if it's Oasis Academy or group or something. It's a lot to do. It helps. With the education process and people that struggle with... Have you heard of it?
No.
Oh, okay. I don't know its full title. But they asked me to give a short speech at their like awards ceremony, which was quite cool. That was in front of like 600 people, and the first time I've ever really done anything that big, and that was kind of like...
That was in front of 600 people?
Anxiety, for God knows how long, going through the speech God knows how many times.
You had to do a speech in front of 600 people?
Mm-hmm. 5-minute speech.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And then I gave a talk with It's Nice That versus Kickstarter as well. They did like a night where me and two other people were talking about their Kickstarter projects and stuff. That one I was most nervous for. There's a video for it out there, and it was on the readings website, but it's not on there anymore because I've just got the one video. But you can find it. And at the beginning, I'm really, really shaky.
Hello, everyone.
I just talk really, really fast. And when I look back, I'm like, oh, God. But then some, like I gave a talk at Ravensbourne University, and that was...
There's a very weird noise above it.
That's really weird. Yeah, I gave a talk at Ravensbourne Uni, and that was, you know, 2 year groups worth, and never bothered me once. But that was really good. I like speaking. It's good. I like talking about the book in front of people. It's good practice because it is an intimidating thing, but at the same time, it's exhilarating afterwards. Like, yeah, you've done it, and it's nice. But on the way, like, it's nice, that one. I had really bad anxiety for like 2 weeks before. It really killed me. Like, the butterflies in my stomach every time I thought about it.
But I think as well that I think most people hate the idea of presenting. But I think most people don't mind presenting if it's about you're the subject matter. So, like, it's not like you can forget anything. Like, you may forget the odd word, but, like, you're right. It's not like anyone in the crowd can go, "That's not what happened." Yeah, you're like, no. This is me. It's my story. I can't mess this one up.
And I guess it's the scary bit of messing up, like the pants down moment, kind of thing. But, you know, no one in that crowd wants that to happen to you. So.
Because it's all, I have the same thing with this podcast every single time I do it. I'm like, what if this is terrible? Like, what if the conversation just goes really badly wrong? And then you do it and you're like, and I love doing it every single time. But it's always like that afternoon, I'm like constantly thinking about it. Okay, it's going to happen. But then it's just, I don't know, I think talking is fun if you're enjoying the subject matter. If at work you have to do a subject on something you know nothing about and you're desperately trying to fudge your way through it. And
people will see it as well. People will see it, of course they will. And I don't know about you, I guess you probably were at uni, but we, from the word go at uni, the 3 years was there, I was forced to talk in front of people. And the first time you do it in your first year, oh my God, talking about your work, and you kind of know that you've winged it last night, and it's trying to talk about it, and the lecturers are looking at you thinking, what have you done? And you're trying to explain, and they question you on it, and you've got no answer. But actually having those moments at uni in that safe environment was so good, so valuable. Of like kind of strip back, like really criticizing your work in front of people, but you're trying to answer it, and you can't. And sometimes you can't answer it, and it's like, I don't know. But then you make sure that next time that is never going to happen. So
did you have any really ridiculous things in the very first week of your first year of uni where they obviously just try and break away the embarrassment threshold? Or like, did you have to do anything stupid? Like, in it,
can't remember,
because we had to do. As an example, for architecture, to try and make us think about, you know, the beauty of fire, it was. So we had to do, this sounds so bad, an interpretive dance in front of the whole school.
No, uni?
Yeah, in a group of 6 people in the first week of first year.
A dance?
At Nottingham Uni. I'm going to name and shame you for making me do this. Yeah, everyone, like, there's 250 people. It's one of the largest architecture years intake. And in front of all of the,
God.
And you had to dance... pretending to be
not the, not the dance is a bad thing, but like, if you're not, if that's
it is,
not
if you,
your thing,
you're hungover and you don't want to do it,
yeah, they're not, well,
and you're a little bit overweight wearing baggy trousers and a really crowded shirt with a bald head.
Yeah, I suppose you just have a few drinks before you go and absolutely kill it, wouldn't you?
No, never kill it.
No, if you were drunk, you'd think you were killing it. And everyone would get a good kick out of it,
and they filmed it as well, and they played
no,
it's so bad.
Wow, no, it was not that bad. But if I could think of a story.
I think it's supposed to help you, but it just really put me off ever doing interpretive dance again, though.
Yeah, were you doing your degree in architecture? Or
I know, right? Yeah, exactly. Am I on the wrong course, Ben? You're not supposed to be here. Oh. Well, I should probably point out that, one, we're already at the hour mark.
Get out.
Yeah, it goes super quickly. I knew this happened. Two, I still want to ask you.
Home.
Yeah, I'm going to wind you up about that in a minute. But I feel that if you're listening to this and you've heard us fidgeting or shivering in way, we're in the Make recording studio, and the radiator is on, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like it's getting colder.
Yeah, and it is so cold outside, and this room is freezing. Yeah. And we've had like a story teacher on this. I just, because I've been watching you talk, and I just, every now and again, I see your hands go under your legs as you're
absolutely freezing. But hey, am I going blue? No, I'm all right. Still alive.
Oh, better put my clothes back on then. So we're going to go back to Kickstarter. I keep holding up my book. I feel like I'm doing my best, like Jonathan Ross impression. Like,
yeah,
you just
I do feel like
sell this book, sell this book.
My next talk, well, interview is within Jonathan Ross. No.
So I want to go back. So with your Kickstarter thing, with your Kickstarter book,
mm-hmm.
your next book, will you do a Kickstarter again?
No. techno.
Why ever not? You seem to be pretty good at it. Huffington Post, two successful Kickstarter campaigns.
Well, it's why it's kind of like it's almost that book. Not with that book.
No, but no. I mean with another idea.
Oh, another absolutely.
Would, because you just said you'd go to another publisher. You'd go to a publisher, sorry.
With that now, yeah.
Oh, with this now, right? Yeah. Got it. Yeah. So your current book, you would, you know, you want to go to get like a. That'd be amazing to get a distribution deal, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's kind of this second book, as much as it's been a massive learning curve, it's been the hardest. Because not only like going from freelancer where I have so much time to do, you have all the time in the world to concentrate other than, you know, the projects that you have at that time, your personal projects with different companies and stuff. But halfway through the Kickstarter campaign, I was here the whole Kickstarter campaign. And that is tough because all you want to do is sit there on your email, just typing out emails to different companies and trying to get as much media as you possibly can. So that was tough. But yeah, just not again with that book. It's done and dusted.
I'm done.
And I'd like to, you know, get it to a publisher and then deal with it. If anyone would take it, that is.
Have you taken it? Like, I'm genuinely curious. Obviously,
we got an offer on the first one, but it just didn't happen. We went to Amsterdam, a publisher in Amsterdam. Me and my brother went, and just at the time, I don't really know why we didn't do it. Plus, I'd also like to mention that every book sold, you get 1% of every book.
What, on Kickstarter?
With certain publishers, you get 1% of every book sold.
Is that good? Is 1% good?
Well, if you sell 50,000 copies, yeah. But if you sell 10, then that's... What, maybe if it's £10, yeah, it's a penny a book, isn't it? It's good, isn't it? People, it's like... I've heard some, like, researching kind of books that have publishers and they get... You know, every month or every 6 months or so, they get money through, and it's like £6.73.
I was having a one of the nice things about doing a book and having something physical is that I was having a conversation with someone about architecture, someone who wasn't an architect, and they were like, "It must be so nice doing a project and that being there forever type thing." You know, or until it gets knocked down, obviously, but it must be great. You know, having a book that you've done. You know, like, and then the next one comes along. Is it? Do you think, oh, you know, I want to add to that? There's always an itch to create something more, or...
Yeah, well, it's like the personal project thing, isn't it? That it's your, like, baby, isn't it? And it's kind of what I like from plumbing to graphic design. There are certain values in that for a long, long, long time, people will be getting a glass of water or having a bath or a shower from stuff that I've fitted in someone's house.
Yeah.
And those people have no idea that it's me. They may even be listening to this and have no idea, and I have no idea there. But that's quite a nice feeling that you've done something in the world, if you know what I mean. You've given something to someone, and that's quite... And helped people in a way, and that's really quite nice. And and the great side is the messages coming back it's a really nicely designed book. The story of it coming back, like, this has really helped me. Like, I can now understand what my kid is going through, what my son is going through. Like, he's been struggling through school and stuff. And I had tear-jerking emails in the first and the second Kickstarter project of, you know, parents like breaking down just in an email, or when they've watched a video start crying because they know that all of a sudden they can potentially get an understanding of what their child's going through at school, and like suffering because of dyslexia and absolutely hating it, when for some reason that we have this perception that in the way that education is in the world, most parts of the world, that it's a bad thing, but actually it's not, and for some reason it is predominantly a bad thing.
Mm.
It's just the way you look at it. But seeing, having those messages come through of like helping people, you can't beat that feeling. That feeling of having that come through, rather than the money, that outweighs it for me. Like getting those, and you know, the hard times of trying to sort the book, it makes it all worth it. And I'm not just saying it because it's you know everyone does say that, but it is true. Like that is why it is worth it. And that's kind of why, I guess, doing the personal projects is worthwhile, because if it is something of value and it does help people, then yeah. I mean, like, you imagine the guys that did the Thames baths, you know, strolling down, like walking along the Thames, they'll never walk down that way the same again when it's built,
yeah.
because they'll see people swimming in them, but like, I did that. And that's what an amazing feeling that you've produced baths, and like, it's helped people, like, to go swimming in London at a cheap rate or whatever. And it's,
I think what I, because one thing I wanted to talk about was at the end of the book, but I'll get that to that in a second. But it's so nice for you to do something so personal to you, something mm-hmm. that you genuinely did struggle with,
yeah.
and it's totally yours. And then to have that feedback, it's not like you've yeah. done it for someone else and they've oh, done yeah. a book. It's yeah. like, it's genuinely yours. Because there's a really nice thing.
It's a funny story about school, actually. That yeah. is quite funny, but at the same time, I guess if you could read into it, it's quite horrible. But it was horrible at the time. My headmaster at a school, he dragged me into his office. And bearing in mind, I was in year three. So how old are you when you're in year three? I don't know. I can't work it out.
Year three. What, secondary school?
Primary school, yeah.
God, I don't know. Like
three or four. It was year three or four.
So you must be, you'd be like eight or nine.
Yeah, something like that. Dragged into his into the headmaster's office after school. Sat at his desk, and he said to me, "So you need to. What's going on with you at school? You need to start working harder." I was like, "Okay, yeah, sorry." Absolutely bricking it, thinking, "Oh my god, what is going on? Am I get chucked out of school? Am I in trouble? Whatever." He's saying to me, "If I don't buck my ideas up, I'll become a dustbin, and my career will be down a pan. I need to start working harder," and giving me this whole spiel about me needing that I'm thick. And he told me, when I leave the office, that I have to put my best foot forward. Obviously, me not understanding that phrase, I was trying to work out. I knew it was my right foot. I didn't know which one was my right foot. Trying to keep that one in front while I was walking along to meet my mum. And she looked at me like, "What are you doing? Why are you walking like a moron?" And he's like, "Oh, he just told me to keep my best foot forward. I've got to start working harder. Come on, I need to go in." He's like, "Right," grabbed me, dragged me into his office. And I thought, "Oh my God, what have I done wrong now?" She had a grilling from him. My mum's gone mental. And now, like, oh God. And then a couple of weeks later, I was in a different school where actually my parents began their fight for a really good education available to me.
Well, that's because the one of the things I was going to talk about was when I was flicking through this, it's got such a nice passage at the back. I guess it's from your mum wrote it.
Yeah.
Really nice. Like, you know, obviously it's nice because it's essentially the struggle that, well, I guess you had, but she had, trying to get you the right education, you know, yeah. and not generally understanding dyslexia in schools. But then... Yeah. To be in this book, which essentially is a success story, it's a really yeah. nice full circle, isn't it? But it's really nice that your mum's so open and honest, you know, and what it is like to have a child with dyslexia in a school that doesn't understand it. I mean, that's yeah. like just frustrating as hell, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, massive. Because it's not, I don't really, my perception of my dyslexia when I was at school doesn't really exist because I didn't want to acknowledge that I had that struggle. I didn't want to acknowledge that I'd be taken away from all my classmates and be put into a different thing. And I just wanted to get on with it and, you know, be in the same classes that everyone else was. So it was almost trying to find a skill in which I could ignore it, if you know what I mean, or trying to get a skill in trying to curve around it.
Yeah, yeah.
And for my parents, it's a completely different story because they obviously see when I got frustrated and they know when something's frustrated me at school because I haven't been able to do it or someone said something in the wrong light and I've taken it as that I can't do it. And I've always kind of had this perception of, you know, in school you have to do every subject, but when you're older, you know, I don't have to do any subject that I don't like.
Yeah.
What baffles me is that, obviously, you have to learn all those things at school because they're important, but why would I do something I'm not good at? Why?
I'm with you on that one, yeah.
Why? What's the point? Like, I wouldn't, I'd like to think I'm a good cook, but at the same time, there's people out there that are not good at cooking, so they won't do it. There's people that are not good at rugby or football, they won't do it. Why would they go and kick a ball around? It's not fun to them. They don't get any kick out of it. They don't enjoy it. They're not very good at it, so you don't do it. So why are these certain things so important for you to study for 6 years, 6 or 7 years of your life, maybe, well, it's more than that, isn't it, of your life, like trawling through it, trying to, and it's like, it's just interesting to me the way that education is kind of run like that. I mean, if I'm not saying that any one subject isn't important, because now I think about it, I would love to go back through science, love to go back through maths, love to go back through English. And even though, you know, it's quite surface level, but especially science, God, that at school, secondary school, I would love to go back through all of that with all the different chemistry set, like stuff. And
no, I love it. I mean, I when I was reading that, I was like, not that I had, you know, the same struggle, but I just didn't enjoy secondary school. And I was like, why? Yeah, sciences, hate science, hate maths, don't want to do it. And it's like, yeah, but it's planting a seed. No, it's just making me never want to do those subjects again. And now I'm like you. I'm like, oh, do you know, I'd love to learn about history now. I honestly cannot remember any history lessons from secondary school. It's like my mind is just blanked out. Like 2 hours a week for like a good 5 years or however long it is.
And it's bad, isn't it?
I can't remember any lessons standing out as like, oh, wow.
Yeah, but that's probably the one thing that outside of work that I'd probably do research, like history and space and... God knows, did you see the space? Well, completely off topic. Did you see the SpaceX rocket, the other one coming down and landing?
The landing one, yeah.
And it this weekend they set off another one with a shuttle on it, and it came down, and the four support legs landed on the pod in the water, but one of the legs it actually physically landed, because you know the first one that they did on the pod in the water, it collapsed and blew up. This one landed, and the one of the supporting legs collapsed and it fell over and blew up. Such a shame. But obviously them knowing that they can do it now, because it did actually land, it like full on landed and it was good. But see, the leg collapsed and it rocked over and blew up. Elon Musk, man,
we're both fascinated by Elon Musk, and we seem to have incredibly similar tastes and stuff, and also hating secondary school, just generally hating school, and then just, it's almost like the harder you push someone down, the weirder their creative things pop up. Right, screw you, I'm going to do something that has no exams in. That was my...
But what a guy, though. Jesus.
There's a really good quote at the end that you pointed out to me today, which I always think, like, that one. That's your quote, isn't it?
One of my favourite ones.
Sometimes it's the very people who no one imagines anything of do the things no one can imagine. Because that, like, the Elon Musk one, he's constantly told, no, that's not how you do things. He's like, yeah, it is. I'm going to do it like this.
And I first heard it from the film, not The Theory of Everything. The Imitation Game.
Oh, yeah.
With... Oh my word, I should really remember his name.
This is one of my favourite games on this podcast, is that they all you'll remember that name 100 times, 99 times 100, but I put a microphone in front of your mouth and I know that people can't remember stuff. What is his name?
Do you know it? Do you know it?
I'm not even entering this game on this podcast. I won't know. And
as soon as this goes off, I'll know it.
I know.
Why don't I know it?
You have no idea how many people do this on the podcast. I can't believe I've forgotten his name. I literally work with him.
Oh, God. Anyway, I had the quote from that film.
But I like the quotes in here because they... this is why I like the book. It all ties in. It's nice. It feels like a...
You know, I'm going to be thinking about that name for a while now, don't you?
Yeah, you can text me later. And then I'll just really crudely beep it in, boop, and then I'll put the name in and then delete it out again.
Oh, God.
I'm not going to let you end the podcast for not remembering this person's name.
I'm not going to remember it. Really bad.
It's gone, isn't it? It's totally gone.
I can see his face and everything. I'm really tempted just to look on my phone.
Don't look on your phone. I want to watch you squirm. Think how many people listen to the podcast just say no,
screaming his name. And I'm not going to listen. That's an annoying thing, because I've got one less of your podcast to listen to now.
Well, there you go.
Yep.
You will listen to this one, though.
No, I won't.
Yeah, it'll be awkward and you won't want to listen to it, but you'll listen to it.
I won't.
Do you know, I can't listen to my podcast again either.
Can you not? Have you ever listened to them?
No, I listen to them like when I'm editing them and when I'm putting the beginning and end on. I used
to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I had to put the images on Acast.
Oh, of course.
But then this season, I've decided not to do it because I realised that no one listens to them through Acast. I mean, they do, but you know, you're saying up market research and hearing back what people say about the thing. I can see that so many people, 95% of people listen through iTunes, which streams it from Acast. Okay. So they don't get the images.
Yeah.
And then I realized myself the Scroobius Pip one, which has images in, and I always say, oh, the Scroobius Pip one does.
Yeah.
Don't ever look at the images. Because for me, I don't know how you listen to podcasts, but you'll be doing something else.
Yeah, exactly.
On your tube, on your bike, on your run, doing work, you're not going to... You know, maybe now someone will go on the Imitation Game, find out which actor you just can't remember, and then, I don't know, like post it on your Twitter or social media or just...
Yeah. It's so annoying because I do know.
I reckon we should just like be completely silent now.
I just want to look on my phone, but you're not going to let me.
Siri, name of Imitation Game.
Can I do it?
You can do it. Go on.
Hey, Siri. What's the name of the guy in the Imitation Game?
Okay, give me a moment. Oh. My web search turns something up for what's the name of the guy in the Imitation Game.
God damn it, Siri.
Alan Turing. God. Why?
How could you forget that person's name?
No, because he's a really important guy, isn't he? So, a big reason why World War II.
Is that your phone?
Sorry, yeah, that is my phone.
How dare you?
Sorry.
I love that we've got a Google word search on the podcast. There'll be people going, they're still talking. Is there any other things they want to search on Google on the podcast?
Switched off by now. This is rubbish.
Because I genuinely feel that you and I could talk for hours, actually. So I'm going to wrap it up here.
Okay.
But I do think that, you know, maybe we should just... I think we should just like...
I don't know if every... I didn't feel like we've covered it all. Have we covered it all? The book stuff that you wanted to ask with Kickstarter?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I think we've done pretty good, actually.
Oh, okay, good.
So I always want to leave these podcasts with someone knowing why to do a podcast, why to do a Kickstarter campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I always think if I want to do a Kickstarter campaign,
yeah,
part of these podcasts are always based around me wanting to do what the other person does.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of, you've said not going to a bank manager.
Yeah.
I love that idea. I love the idea that you can have your own fairly random idea and you have to run with it. There's so many people who are going, oh, do you know what? I had this idea, but it's not, I can... And they come up with a load of reasons. And then if you actually gave
income
them...
voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what your internal monologue is? That?
Yeah. Just an angry camp person going to go at me. But I think that you make me want to do a Kickstarter campaign.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to do a book because this is really good. But, you know, it just makes you think of how many different things you could...
Well, I think that, like I said to you before, I think I wouldn't beat yourself up about... okay, right, let's do a Kickstarter campaign. Because you've got to
you told me that's the wrong attitude to have, isn't it?
Yeah. Reverse it a little bit and wait. Well, not wait, but, you know, continue to, like, study stuff and, you know, explore stuff and making things, but not with the intention of, okay, I'm going to make this thing to go on Kickstarter because, you know, well, you know, some people probably have done it and it's been really successful, but I almost think that it may... bring up barriers or...
Are there rules that you have to have a product to sell? Like, I couldn't go...
I think there's certain...
Can I have £50,000 take a year off work to do a podcast? to go around the world and do a podcast? I mean, you can't... You
I
have
don't
to
see
have
why
a...
not. I think... Because you can't... I think there's... Your project can't be based around charity, I think, is one of them. Mm. So it can't be... solely around money, raising money for charity, basically. I think there's a few other rules, but I can't remember them. There's very, very few rules. But yeah, you can do that. Some guy raised money for mashed potato or something funny like that. Absolutely something ridiculous like that. A bowl of like mashed potato or something. I can't remember what it was. It was so ridiculous.
There's always someone who tries to test the system, isn't there?
But you see what it wasn't. It wasn't Kickstarter, but did you see what Cards Against Humanity did in two different separate campaigns? Not Kickstarter, but two different sets of times. Once they did something where they advertised to sell. I don't know if it's actual shit or not, but they sold and made a load of money from it. shitload of money for it. And then this Christmas, it was Black Friday. It was to pay for £5 for absolutely nothing. And they made $75,000 from it. And they sold nothing. They weren't giving anyone anything. They were just basically asking for money for free. But it's obviously, I guess the point is that their brand and their brand model is...
Because Cards Against Humanity, it's amazing the first time you play it, and then it gets really old really quickly. But the first time you play it with a group of people, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
Especially if there's some slightly prudish person who is a little uncomfortable with rude things. Then
definitely makes a...
Because it's... I've never, never had like Jeremy Beadle as a trump card. You know, like there's certain things that you can you have certain conversations.
Exactly, it makes you do that, then like,
never,
whoa.
Yeah. Can I put those three things together?
I win.
If you've not played Cards Against Humanity, I highly recommend playing it with your parents.
Yeah.
Or your grandma.
Yeah.
Grandma and the easily offended. Like,
listening to the Chris Moyles podcast. Yeah, Chris Moyles podcast, and Jamie Oliver was on it, and he was saying about things you can do at Christmas, and he re-engineers his like crackers and stuff all like for the family and stuff, and his gran's there and everyone's there, and for once for his gran, he took out everything and put and bought a packet of a Viagra, but switched the Viagra out for Skittles. I think he just got the box and put Skittles in it. And his gran opened it and was like, oh, and got, like, started to get quite excited about it. And he started laughing. And it was just like, it's a joke, gran. It's Skittles. And she did, like, all of a sudden started to look quite disappointed. Like, it's funny. That's a good podcast.
Right.
It's funny.
And on that note, I do genuinely think we should do some sort of more regular podcast where we just talk about films and other stuff that we've done.
What, me not remembering famous people's names, very important people's names?
Well, the nice thing is, so there's two different types of people that listen to this podcast. There's the first 20 minuters who listen to, and I try and like condense what
I
want.
Can you see that then? Can you see how long people listen to it for?
Yeah. But only
what happens if they only, if they put, because sometimes, you know, you don't listen to the full amount, you'll listen... I listen to half, then half later. Or something.
Well, Acast, you can't get the stats. Only they have the stats.
Oh, okay.
But they told me, that's their business model. Is they know, you know, how long people listen to it for and whatever. But so they've said that, you know, like quite a few people, half roughly listen to the first 20 minutes, half an hour, and then the other half listen all the way through, right? So everyone listens to the first half an hour, whatever. But I like the fact that there'll be people listening to this. Who, if you're listening past the first half an hour, then you'll listen to all the way through of just talking random rubbish.
Yeah, but I went off at the tangent a few times.
I know, but that's what the great thing about the podcast, because what's the Joe Rogan one? That's like 3 hours.
Yeah. You would want to go off in a fair few tangents, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But they're really good, though. I really enjoy them. And, you know, some ones that are only half an hour, the Infinite Monkey Cage, sometimes half an hour. It's like, no, he's just got started. And especially on subjects that they're tackling, it's like, you want him to keep going and going and going and going. You can listen to that one all day long.
Because I was trying to explain to my dad, he was like, because he listened to the Wooden Overcoats one I did last week. And he's so bad at just giving me really backhanded insults. He's like, yeah, you don't really talk about anything, do you, Ben? I'm like, it's an hour and a half long. We talk about loads of stuff. And he's like, yeah, but I think like there's certain people who just want information given to them in the most concise. I was like, yeah, Dad, I talk about you at an hour and 25 minutes. Force him to listen all the way through. Right. And on that note, I'm going to wrap it up and say thank you so much for being on the podcast.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
There we go. That was episode number 15 of the Create More podcast with Sam Barkley. That was cool, right? I hope you enjoyed that. That was, I listened back to that and I'm chuckling away. And so something we touched on, but I'm pretty sure we're going to do is, I think me and Sam's going to become like my co-presenter, and we're going to do like when the end of this series, we're going to do like a review set of podcasts, where we go back and, I think we might do 2 or 3 podcasts per episode or 4 or something. Do like 4 or 5 episodes every 2 weeks where we kind of go back and discuss them. Because when I did the presentation at Make, I suddenly realized that every single one of the podcasts, whilst the podcast is only an hour, there were so many big themes that I was really, really, I really enjoyed talking about. And Sam is one of the few people who has listened to almost all the podcasts. So we talk endlessly at work about the podcasts. There's just, yeah, so I want to talk about them. So that also, you know, I have a imminent child being born, so I was a little aware that maybe I won't have as much free time as I used to. So this might be a nice way to continue the podcast without running me into the ground. So yeah, you should definitely go on Sam's website and buy his book. There you go, shameless plug. But I also realized I spelt his website wrong. Well, it is very, very difficult to spell on purpose, but let me get this properly right. So it's reedeeng.com. And you should go there, like buy like 100 copies. Yeah, because it'll make him really wealthy. And then I might get some of the money because I gave you the shout out. So do it. Thank you so much for listening. The next Kickstarter one, as I said, will be with Peter, who's done the this amazing folding bike, which I think he said he's like in talks with like big bike manufacturers. And what's cool is, if I didn't know him, I would say that this is like an amazingly successful Kickstarter campaign. And what's been amazing is to see him. You know, he gets people at Mate to take photos, and he's in the Make office, and he's, you know, moving his bike around. I've kind of seen him with his prototype, and just, again, I'm always looking for that bit where you go from not doing an idea to having a really successful idea. I'm constantly trying to work out and talk to people about that bit in between. And to see someone's go really, really well, just like Sam's, to see Peter's kind of go from strength to strength and be and feel like I've seen him do every step of the way, is very inspiring. I think people who don't see that don't understand how easy it is to start something. And the more I see it, the more I want to do more things, because the only difference is you just get up and do it. You know, I'm no better than anyone else. I guess it's just like everyone, just have an idea and go for it. So go on, start a Kickstarter campaign, do it on anything. You won't regret it. Unless it gets really bad and it's really embarrassing for you, then you probably will regret it. Yeah, probably don't do that. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in next fortnight.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Thank you. Bye-bye.